You are listening to Atlantis 3D Radio.
Such a tragedy. Do you believe what is our perfection disappears into the sea? And I'll leave logic to those with a conscience and a reason for this world. And I'll pray.
Back to Atlantis 3D Radio. I'm your host, Jason, and it is an incredibly stormy day here at the corner of the Bermuda Triangle where we record this podcast. Today is part two of the Michael Desarian interview that we recorded on January 3rd. The music that you heard at the beginning was performed by a band named Never Then, and the song title is Atlantis. So we're going to go over, and I'm going to put the rest of the interview on for you guys, and I'll see you guys at the end of this podcast, because I have many thanks to give for all the support that I've been receiving for this podcast. Enjoy.
People go to, for instance, to my articles, michaeldesarian.com, go through to the article section. On the article, Weapons of Mass Destruction Found, and on the conspiracy, on the Constitution Con article, right, there's two articles there, you'll see the quotes from leading governors, presidents, and presidential advisors, what have you, totally sycophantically adoring, worshiping, drooling over the royal families. Joe Kennedy, for instance, was obsessed by having at least one of his sons. He had six sons, I think, and one daughter. He was an Anglophile. He was a well-known Anglophile. Read any biography of Joe Kennedy, and you'll find that he was obsessed with England, with the British aristocracy, with the royal family.
Right.
And was absolutely obsessed by getting at least one of his children married into British aristocracy, and he actually did it. His daughter is the one who actually went over and married some extremely senior duke. I never can remember who it is. She did that. And he brought up all the rest of his sons to adore Britain. And therefore, basically, that amounted to having America sold out, because them and like so many others that was their idea, to not only get into deep business relationships with British companies, because that would lead, of course, then to knighthoods and awards. And we now know that even people in the Federal Reserve and other members of the Bush and Clinton and Reagan administration have gone and taken awards, Norman Schwarzkopf and so many others I could mention. They've all gone this route. This became a pattern, you know, from the time of Roosevelt, that go and kowtow and try to become on the board of governors, try to have deep business relationships with these British companies, so that that might lead to governorships and all sorts of appointments. And then finally, if you're very lucky, it might even get you knighted and what have you, you see. So this has been a going concern. Now, this should raise a red flag to any American right away, and these people should be totally thrown out of office and arrested.
When you pointed out, like, to me, when I saw what you were pointing out with George Bush, you know, one knee to the Queen of England,
yeah,
I said, wow. And you also pointed out that, you know, we've become, you know, so damn amnesiac that we've forgotten who our original enemies were.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this is George absolutely III. Right.
That's right. George III swore eternal war on the Americans for what they did during the War of Independence. Eternal war.
Right.
Now, a king's word is a command to his lieutenants. And therefore, does that not explain why there is no freedom anymore here? Why the federal government have their tentacles everywhere? Why communitarianism is rampant in this country? Why outsourcing is rampant? All the things that you're seeing did not just happen by accident or happenstance or the greed of corporations like some lower level types of PBS level. Commentators are probably going to tell you that is false and can be proven to be false. And you find it turning up in a lot of books where they're so tame, they're so lame, they're so weak-willed and so gullible or misinformed or duplicitous that they simply will not face the facts.
Right.
You have so many politicians who go sort of halfway and just say, you know, like the certain the Ralph Nader types, the sort of Ron Paul types, they'll go to a certain level by saying, it's just, if we could just get rid of the greedy corporations.
Yeah.
You mean to tell me that that's it? That's the reason? Absolutely false.
Yeah.
Absolutely false.
It's absolute rubbish, in my opinion.
Of course it is. That is what they've done is that, yeah, I agree with them to one point where I would say, yes, of course, the elite I'm talking about does operate through these corporations. That I'll give you. But they have created a corporate front, a corporate mask, so that the mug in the street will literally think it is only greedy such and suches who are doing this, the George Soros, you know, parasite who's, or the Greenspan cockroach.
Yeah.
That's true to a point. That's true to a point. But my God, a man who only sees that, who's still myopic enough to believe in that political, it's very comfortable. Just let get rid of the greedy capitalists. Well, when we hear people on the floor of the Senate, well-meaning as they are, rail on about the horrible economic disaster that's taking place, and if only we could get these greedy men to have a conscience. You know, sorry, that's fine and dandy, and that's all right for what it is, but it's scripted. It's made to order because they want the vast majority of Americans, especially in a period of meltdown, who may be asking questions, we want to give you a pseudo-answer, and we want to make sure that that answer leads you away from the real answer. All politicians, almost all of them, their job is to lead you away from the true oracle of truth. But to do that, they must give you a simulacra of truth, a chimera of truth, so that you'll think, yeah, there's a lot of truth to this. Hey, I went and checked that out. You know, this really is the case. And every so often, you'll have this revelations taking place on the internet or in the public media about some greedy corporation that's just been uncovered in Europe and, you know, some other greedy type of George Soros type who's been sucking off the blood or whatever, and we rush down there thinking, great, we've discovered the source of all of these problems, you know? And they don't even mind at certain periods of history even sacrificing some of their own gang if they need to, you know, sacrifice somebody. I mean, on a chessboard game, you have the sacrifice of the king.
Sure, collateral damage.
Yeah, collateral damage. So if a couple of Rothschilds have to be taken out or there's a pogrom now and again, hey, that's just good entertainment, whatever, we can handle it. We'll get a lot of other things done while that's taking place as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, it's the same thing. You're going to go in, you're going to take out all these oligarchies, you're going to, you know, get rid of the, you know, the New World Order. But it's just like we're doing exactly the same process as we did to begin
over
with.
Over and over. Over and over again.
You know, we started it this way, you know?
Don't go to the nucleus. And as I said, the nucleus is partly a psychological type of undertaking. Very much like what you see in movies of sophistication, like The Matrix and many others I could mention. They are alluding to that to a certain degree. But I will go much further than that. I will say that unless consciousness is brought into the picture, unless certain amounts of psychology and philosophy are involved in this, there is not a hope in hell that you're going to unplug that nonsense. Because unfortunately, this serpent is so clever that it's plugged into you. You are part of its activity. It's so occult. It's so subtle. It's so truly Luciferian that your very energy of life, the energy that you expatiate through emotion, through stress, through anxiety, through action even, it feeds on. It's an amazing thing when you start discovering it. It's not just out there over the hill, those guys. That's what they want you to think, because at the very most, all you'll ever be able to do is create one little faction, one little coterie, and then you've just put a target on your back. Now they know where to come and get you. Then they remove the leader of that particular action group, and the rest of them just fall apart.
Yeah. What do you think about this in WikiLeaks guy? They're posting all over the place, and every news channel, Rush Limbaugh, talking about they need to create a terrorist cell out of them.
It's the same thing. It's more dust. It's more. It's 70-30. It's more chaos on top of more chaos.
Yeah.
It may give you a certain amount of truth, but it's mostly designed to lead you away from even greater things that are being done in politics today.
This is my suspicion too. It's poppycock, you know. It's in your face, you know. And then they can say, "Oh, well, look at this. We got to do something about this. We need to, you know, take away the ability for us to communicate on the internet and whatnot." And they'll use it as a catalyst too, as well.
Well, it would help people to understand that, first of all, we've never been in a state of peace on this planet for probably hundreds, if not thousands of years. Politics is war.
Right.
So when the legions of St. George were, not St. George, but King George, when the legions of the British realized that they couldn't hold America for want of arms. They got an empire, remember. Any troops they send over here, they're going to weaken the empire back in Europe. And they have lots of people who are fed up with them, their control in Europe too. So they obviously realized that, look, it's not going to work through force of arms. And by the way, these Americans are a tough nut to crack. They're mostly Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
And they kick our ass. They hate us with a passion. So it's not going to work. But of course, you have the extreme hard-assed general military types who think that, you know, everything can be solved by just killing and war. So they had to go through their little process. They couldn't be stopped, and therefore you had the war.
Right.
But the higher intelligence in the alpha lodges of Freemasonry, and these, as I say, Judaic enclaves, and the Knights of the Garter, and the Knights and the members of the Privy Council. People can look online and find out these things. I've got links to them galore on my websites. The Privy Council, the Order of St. George and St. Michael, all of these people were saying, that's not going to work. You don't hold down an entire continent hundreds of times bigger than your country. The whole of Ireland fits inside Lake Michigan, for God's sake. England isn't much better. You cannot do it through force of arms. They're mad to even try, but let them do it, because, you know, that creating that skirmish and creating that poverty and creating that chaos, yeah, we're all for it. It doesn't matter. But don't ever think for a moment that that's how we're going to colonize that country.
Right.
They already set the work to say we're going to do it economically through the Hudson Bay Company, Virginia Company, Massachusetts Bay Company. They're also in rivalry against the Spanish, who had come a lot earlier than the Puritans and were well in North America. So they had competition. They had competition from Russia, not Soviet Russia, but the original Russia.
Yeah.
So they knew that they had to work economically. Put your men in, put your henchmen in, create this federal system. Then that federal system will spread out and occupy the states. Until now, you have what is a completely federal lockdown system. There's no such thing as state-controlled power in this country anymore. That didn't happen overnight. It's a lengthy process. And since there were a certain amount of intelligent people here, like the Thomas Paines and the Edmund Burkes and a lot of very intelligent men who were looking at this and maybe would have spotted it, and they were. There was people like Jefferson and others who did spot that something was going wrong. You have to pacify that kind of intellectual mind with a lot of talismanic documents, which we know as the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and so on. You've got to give them the illusion that it's going to be free and non-oligarchic and so on. But they left the door open in the ways that I've described in my work. They've left the door open for this same royalistic power to take over.
On the surface, they've locked the front door with a cage and a metal grate and padlocks, but the back door is left wide open.
That's exactly what they did. And that always worked. That's worked throughout history.
Right.
And it's no different here. So the Russell Trust, the British East India Company, or the Dutch East India Company, BP, I mean, you name it. Most of the corporations that you know today are in some way connected to this royal force. And then what you do is you also then professionally or physically assassinate anyone who might have a snifter of the truth, which I do believe included people like Lincoln and a few others. You've got to get rid of them. If they should ever get a snifter of the truth and start to, and not only that, but they have power too. It's not, anybody can have a snifter of the truth. They're not worried about them. They're worried about if you also have the command of people, of an army or any kind of, you know, political clout. That's when they get worried and they will move to take you out.
Yeah, when people start listening, in other words.
Exactly. And that's when they bring out their champions, the Louis Farrakhans, the Ron Pauls, mm-hmm. Bill O'Reilly's, they have a whole other battalion of just ape-like creatures who just go out there to point fingers and throw accusations. So whenever the truth is coming, or wherever you might start to get a glimmer of it, they immediately unleash the robots. Huh. All paid for them. Now, on the surface, they look like they're members of different orders, different powers, different political affiliations, left wing, right wing. The whole full rivalry ensues, you see. And we get lost in that. Our inspiration is taken up on one side and we have false allegiance. We think, oh, this is really going to work. And we know who our enemy is, supposedly. And unfortunately, the masses of mankind have been able to be completely, stymied by this. And so if people listening to us only get one single fact, one area of study that they should go, and it is to study this divide and rule policy, because that will open the door to a lot of other things.
Right.
But never forget, they control the institutions. They control the government, they control the schools and colleges, they control the medical, the big pharma, and they control from higher up the media, so that it's very unlikely. And therefore, that's why it comes back to like what we were saying at the beginning of our show, where stop waiting for everybody else to get onto this. It's going to be something that you have to do individually. And the moment that you realize that, whether you know it or not, it's like I said at the Bath conference, now it's become holy work as a matter of fact. The very moment that you might have to do something on your own, in my estimation, constitutes a sacred act. Not the sacred act as you might be thinking in a church or a mosque or a synagogue. No, no, no. The real thing, the real esoteric awakening is now taking place in your life. And there will come an enormous cost for that. And when you say that I'm willing to pay that cost, that's the moment that you become truly independent.
Yes. In other words, do what you will to me. You're not going to shut me up. You're not going to stamp me down. You're not going to step on my face, you know?
That's right. Because you've fallen in love with knowledge. You've fallen in love with the fact that knowledge is worth the price. Like Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. You know, the greatest ignorance, the greatest evil is ignorance, the greatest good knowledge. They've all said it. Well, we're at a time right now moving towards, we're in an age right now in which that is going to be very, very tested. People are now being literally tested on an individual basis. It's based on what's happening in astrologically and so on. And if you say something's based astrologically, what you really mean is it's psychological.
Right.
Because the stars, the so-called stars, is only one way of mapping what's going on in this collective psyche of people.
Right.
And so that's what's happening now. People are being separated, the sheep from the goats. That's why you have the rise of, say, somebody like Michael Tesarian and David Icke. We're not just here by happenstance either.
Right.
Our work is very much part of a movement we're not in control of. It's ordained by something far higher.
I remember once you had said, and I never really took astrology seriously until I actually heard you say this, it was that even the life at the bottom of the ocean follows the lunar cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? You know, if the moon has this effect, why not the systems and the planets?
Yeah, I've looked into that so deeply, the whole underlying principles behind any of these things, like astrology or divination for that matter, what it basically boils down to a simple question of what are the connections between mind and matter?
Yeah.
And boy, that's the endless subject, really. That is where you really gain the great insights.
Oh, yes.
When you start, first you have to ask, in other words, it's like the old statement, before you can have the answer, you must know how to ask the right question. One of the right questions to be asking in this life, there are more important ones like, what am I doing here and where am I going? But secondary to that is the question of, what are the actual intimate connections between the mind, the so-called mental energy, as Wilhelm Reich would have called it, bioenergetic energy,
right,
and physical energy. And this opens the door not only to a proof of astrology, but a proof of many other things like relationships and all sorts of other dynamics that go on in this world.
Well, as a human race, we've been on to this, haven't we? We have the whole philosophy of qi coming out of China and metaphysical practices of exercise, just even good manifest that, you know, physically.
Oh, yeah, and they were adamant about whether or not there is a duality. You know, they have that yin-yang symbol, which
right,
is probably called the Tai Chi symbol.
It's a Taoist symbol, yeah.
The Taoist symbol, yeah, and you see these two movements, the black and the white. Isn't it amazing that there is always an opposite to something? And then don't forget that the line, the sort of curvy line that runs between those two black and white fish-like symbols, that line matters as well. That is a third part of the line of this symbol. And then you might even say that the circle, the line of the circle that encloses it, we forget that symbol is always in a circle. That circle itself is yet a fourth part now.
Wow, yeah.
So when people look at it, they think, oh, there's a duality, black and white. Hey, isn't that interesting? Yeah, but the line that divides them is the third, and the circle that encases them is the fourth. So there's actually four things you're looking at. There's four phenomena to reality, four phenomena to your psyche, four phenomena to the bedrock of the universe, you see. So one thing, again, Len, leads to the other. They're trying to, through symbolism,
right,
teach you something.
My Tai Chi instructor told me, if you're looking at the symbol of yin-yang and you see black and white, you're really missing the point.
That's a good point. I've been learning that myself. I think there's a lot of truth to this. And don't forget that the Taoist people even have a triad. They have a sort of a three-legged symbol,
sure,
very similar to the Irish Triskelion, you know.
They have the three wise men of Taoism.
I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, there's three guys.
Three wise men of Taoism.
And they were also always represented with the moon behind their head, much like we see in contemporary Christian artwork with the solar symbolism. Very amazing stuff, you know. If you look at it and then look at that, you'll go, oh, right away, you'll see it. You know what I mean? You know, it's like,
yeah,
how is it just so in your face right there?
Uh-huh. We have the three pillars of the Kabbalistic tree of life,
yeah,
jumps to mind.
We always see this tripart sort of thinking, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm fascinated with this. I've been looking into it. This is interesting what you're saying here. It's very interesting. Because what appears to be a duality often is not. It's a matter of you're the perceiver, so you're the third thing.
Right.
The perceiver who's seeing the duality is a third thing, which automatically negates duality. So it's a very interesting line of inquiry, that is.
Yeah, I've been into this for quite a while, trying to, you know, who is the I who's observing the notion of I?
Right. Yeah, and then the I is split into, like when you hear your mind, you have this internal dialogue. There's a listener and a speaker.
Right.
You hear your thoughts as a series of words or a series of comments that you think is your voice. You've learned to think of it as your voice. And there's also another part of you listening to this internal voice. So there's actually two people inside your head, or two of you, a listener and a speaker. I've always thought that that's remarkable.
Yes.
So right away, the so-called I is almost a syzygy. Just as in the same way you might be talking to somebody else, you know? Shall I go to dinner tonight, or shall I watch that TV program? Yeah, okay, go ahead and watch it. There's a sort of internal dialogue. We all know there's an internal dialogue. But we've never actually thought about the fact that, wait a minute, who's the speaker and who's the listener?
Yeah. And I've also thought about, how did this occur in the first place? You don't see the animals doing that, you know?
No. They have logic. They operate through what we might be called a logical actions. Like you kick a dog once, it's certainly not going to come near you again. That's
sure.
Logical.
Sure.
Right? It knows when to come in and go, and the food will be out. But it's not rational. Like, man is rational. Man is the only being who can ask questions about, why am I here? What's the meaning of life? Animals don't question what's going to happen after they die, and they don't think about the meaning of their existence. For some strange reason, whether it's good or bad, we can argue, is man has the ability to question his own existence.
Hmm.
Now, that is, of course, different philosophers have their different take on what to do with that and why we even ask it and where it will lead. Well, that's where all the schools now differ, or the whole world of religious and philosophical schools appear, because everyone has their own particular take on that. Some schools say there's no such thing as the I, it's all an illusion. Others go, no, it's the I is the center, the self is the most important part of you, don't ever negate it. And then you have all the people in between, you think.
Right. Yeah. It's such a fascinating study to me, you know, the whole idea of consciousness. And how did this occur, this origin of evil, as you put it so eloquently in that talk? What is the origin of evil? What is this, you know, pointing out evil and good? Where does it come from? How do we even get there in the first place?
Well, I stick to that. I have never seen anything yet. That was years ago, and I wrote that in the Atlantis book, and I've never seen one thing to shake my understanding of that. In fact, if anything, it's got stronger and stronger and stronger. I'd not say it's the only reason for the birth of the ego, but it certainly is one of the major contributing factors, I do believe to this day, was physical. Physical trauma, physical, physiological trauma brought on by catastrophe. People can say, well, I know Tassarian thinks that catastrophe was man-made. Yeah, well, even if you don't go that far, even if you don't believe that the catastrophes that are all written in mythology was brought on by what I say it was, which was wars of the gods,
right. It
wouldn't matter. The very fact is that any and all catastrophes, be they completely natural and random, cosmological, like with comets or whatever, the fact is that catastrophe changed consciousness. You're not just sitting in an armchair passively when the whole world is erupting around you and pole shifts are taking place. So why has nobody ever asked, in a deep way, what that might have done to consciousness? And those who have asked it, they're not very successful at coming up with really good answers. The only one that's really close is Julian James, the author of the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind,
okay. Where
he claims that he alludes to the fact that there was a trauma that created a kind of psychosis. He's kind of a little bit shady on what caused it. For me, there's no doubt about it. It was enormous earth cataclysms, as pointed out by umpteen scholars, including Immanuel Velikovsky and others, Commons, Beaumont. Okay, so then I say, all right, given that that happened, given that consciousness was traumatized, what would have happened? This is where everybody goes blank.
Sure.
For me, it's a clear understanding that the ego that we know today, with all of its fears, phobias, anxieties, schizoid proclivities, its weird tendencies, its fallibility, the fact that it even is very vulnerable, that it has certain physiological and psychological fears. To me, the ego as we know it is the product. It's not consciousness as it was before the cataclysm, but it's a consciousness that we have inherited after the cataclysm.
Yeah.
And then that ego, being very small, very fragmentary, and very fragile, itself has to create enormous defenses even just to protect its own suzerainty, to protect its own identity. And those defenses are well known to psychologists. Those defenses are what is almost a hallmark of ego identity.
Right.
But as we know, the trouble is, as we know, any wall you build to keep something out eventually keeps you in. It's that yin-yang again. So it did something that it needed to do. You can't blame the ego for doing it. It wouldn't be in existence. No form of consciousness. We'd be back to the level of the animal. There would be no consciousness to speak of unless the ego did do that, had these incredible defenses against the titanic forces, not only physical but internal. But unfortunately, it built them so strong that it became the man in the iron mask. It became the prisoner in the mask.
Wow.
And left itself open to yet another kind of undoing, another kind of toxicity, the toxicity of extreme conservatism, the disease of absolute imprisonment within its own creation, you see? And that creates a madness of its own. So the kind of madness that we know today, anxieties, what do you call it, schizophrenia, neurosis, whatever, those erupted, their roots are in the catastrophe, there's no doubt about that. But there's a secondary kind of neurosis that arose within the mind itself, the ego itself, just because it's imprisoned within its own wall. It's like a prisoner who's never let out of his cell, or an animal that's continually caged there. The cage protects it, yes, but it's going stir crazy.
Hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
So the ego, this is the way I look at it, that the ego has become stir crazy, and now new pathologies are developing, new levels of apprehensiveness, higher rates of sociopathy, higher rates of depression as we go. And it's because the ego defenses are so strong, you see. So there's a whole study of the anatomy of consciousness based on the idea that there was a catastrophe, that man has suffered fallout from it, that the thinking of man is deranged, and then another separate analysis of the ego itself just by the very fact that it created these defenses.
I mean, you can take a peace-loving man who's calm, never would harm a fly, put him in the middle of a war zone, put a gun in his hand and have people shoot at him, and he'll come back a changed man. He won't be the same. He'll be sleeping with that gun in his hand, even when he's at peacetime.
They've done it. Look, we're three meals away from revolution.
Yeah.
The girlfriend leaves, and we're like a dismembered maggot. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much. The girlfriend talks to another guy, and we're in a state of a complete meltdown because she was flirting. All right? This is where we're at.
Right.
Yeah. Somebody got a job above us. That was for me. What the heck are you doing?
Yeah.
Promoting that sucker over my head. I'm going to go in with an AK-47 and shoot you all up.
Yeah, it's extreme cases of envy, not jealousy. Yeah.
Envy, jealousy, competitiveness. We're talking earlier about the child being not a free agent. Jesus Christ. Just observe how the parent infects the child with competitiveness.
Oh, my God, yes, yes. This is so prevalent here in America. You can't imagine if you're not
all
from
all over the
here.
World. Same in Ireland.
Same there as well. I could only
speak. What's free about that?
Nothing.
Maybe the kid doesn't want to be the head rat in the rat race.
Yeah. You see the little cheerleaders, you know, their parents pushing them into the cheerleading. They're going to be the perfect little cheerleader, you know, and they fail one contest and their whole world's shattered. They're just in tears, you know.
That's it. This is the tyranny, the dictatorship that takes place right in the ubiquitous, soft forms. It's so ubiquitous we don't even notice it. But this whole thing about the consciousness, the social persona, the fact that in order to defend ourselves against what we now call the unconscious. And those defenses are obviously not the same thickness in every human being. So those whose walls are a little bit less thick are the clairvoyants, the poets, the imaginative ones, those who still they can hear the echoes of that ancestral voice. They may be more inspired. They may be philosophically inclined, spiritually inclined, whatever. The ones whose walls are too thick, you know, this is the five senses world. They're defensive. They're competitive. They're confrontational. They're the phallic narcissists. They're the ones who the world is all that there is, and I just got to make it and compete. And then at 50, they're sitting on a psychiatrist bench going, hey, doc, I don't know what's going on. My mind is falling apart. Yeah, well, there might be reasons for that.
Yeah.
You know, but then even then, they're looking for an expert to fix them. Like you're taking your car in for a tune-up. Now they think, my brain's deranged. I don't have responsibility for it. Where's that expert? Where's that psychologist?
Where's the pill, you know?
Yeah. And then they even resist the psychologist. They're paying.
They blame the Yeah.
One psychologist, right? I forget his name. He's a very famous Los Angeles psychoanalyst. His method of course, he's not the only one to use this, but he's one who uses it a lot. His therapy ended up being based on tape recording the sessions and then giving a tape of the session to the patient. And having them take it away for the week or whatever it was and listen back to it many times and then come back to him after the patient had listened to the tape on which they're talking. And what the psychologist was trying to get them to do is to listen to the amount of times they lie to themselves in the tape, in the session.
Yeah.
The amount of fiction that's involved in their account of what's going on in their lives. And it worked. It actually worked. It's actually something you can do for yourself. And they said that the patient's healing took place the moment that they learned the level of self-deception that's in their life, the way they misconstrued things just blatantly. And they were so horrified, right, by their own ability to lie through their teeth and not even know it, that they came back in a much more humble form for the session the next time. And what I'm really getting to here is not so much about what I've just said. It's this. What part of the person felt bad about the fact that they were lying? This is what the psychologist was doing this for, and he was relying on this. It's called the conscience. He was hoping that by going through this elaborate thing of taping the thing and letting the client listen back to it, he would activate something far higher. What he refers to as something in their higher mind, which is, of course, what we call conscience. Even though these people were in a state of total self-deception, even though these people were lying to themselves, there still was another higher voice, a higher sense of self, a higher sense of rightness, a higher conscience that said, it's not right that you did that. You're a better person than that. So in all teachings, in all spiritual teachings, in all philosophical ways of looking at life, we have to address that higher self in us. We have to address that conscience. I'm not speaking about a higher self like in some Eastern mystical way. Right. I'm talking about just this other voice, this other way of seeing. It's not another being within you or any sort of Atman or anything like that. It's a simply new way of seeing. Everything that we attribute to a god or a demon is really a way of seeing. It's an attitude of mind. It's not, we somehow personify it, which is a kind of a very limited, infantile way of doing it. The way of seeing that told these people, my God, is this how you're running your life? No wonder you're sick. You've got to change your ways. Well, it's at that moment, and we're now approaching a time in history, you see, where this conscience is going to work in a lot of people, the ones who are still got that something, something inside them. I believe that conscience is now driving them crazy. A lot of people in my field and others are thinking, oh, that's a bad thing. We don't want to do that. And then run back to the official established religions and paradigms. I'm not for that. I like the trouble. I want people to not feel good about justice and corruption. I want them to see something evil die and be glad about it, celebrate it. I don't want them to sustain and hold on to the old rotten edifice, you see.
Right.
Not within themselves or within society.
People don't want to do any self-work. They want to be told exactly what to do at the exact moment.
That's right.
They don't want to do anything for themselves.
I get this all the time. You can't imagine how many emails I get going, give me advice, Michael. And I've said, I don't know how many times I've said in my work, I don't give advice.
Right.
My advice to you is go and do your own homework and find out who you are. That's my advice.
Yeah, you mentioned, you go and you mention one thing to someone, and they instantly say, oh, you're the expert. Please, teacher. Please, master. I'll sit down and you teach me. And I'm on autopilot now.
And it's not to say that there isn't masters in the world and there aren't intellectually superior people. There are.
Right.
It's the adoration of that kind of person. In fact, even the adoration isn't wrong. What's wrong is that you are allowing yourself to be a nothing in comparison to that greater mind. You're coming to him not to really learn. You're coming to lean. You're coming to take. You're coming to vampirize. You're coming to say, I don't want to be me.
Right. You're looking for a crutch.
All the time, this is what it is. It's covered up by saying, oh, no, I'm seeking for peace. I'm seeking for meaning. I'm seeking for higher knowledge. No, you're not. You're trying to become an infant again because you are that emotionally and you are that psychologically anyway. And now by the time you're 30, you're so sick of your emotions and sick of yourself, you're looking for any way that you can go to any altar, any shrine, any guru that'll say, yeah, sit there and become a child again. And here's 100 other guys that want to do the same thing as you're doing. So you're all well happy. Just sit there, my children. Turn off your minds and let me edify you with all my stories and tales of God.
Yeah, and here's the collection plate. Please chip in your money.
Exactly. You see, and remember, like Nietzsche always predicted, you burn down one of these edifices, another pops up in its place. This is going to be with man forever. Even if somebody says, whoa, I can't wait till Christianity is downsized. Yeah, you may wait. And even if it does become downsized and completely redundant, another thing equally pernicious will creep up, because as long as man does not deal with the underlying root of the problem, his own psychological need for conformity and submission, then something again in another hybrid form, except this time it'll be in a Star Trek form of religion, plug it in, another kind of dictatorship will take place. Man will always craving for that authority, no matter what planet you're on, no matter what galaxy you're on, no matter what time you're on. It infects everything. So our hierarchies are, numerous throughout the world, in science, in religion, in schooling, in education. Everywhere you find the hierarchy, the pestilence.
It seems to be almost an endless pea soup of this kind of behavior amongst all humans.
And I think it is. I think it is. And I actually probably think that it was... I can't rule out that other people in previous periods of history wouldn't have cracked it, but
yeah.
I am actually more leaning towards the idea that it can't be cracked or hasn't been able to be cracked until now. We may be even historically, this is kind of way out there, but we may even be historically at the time where this is the only chance we get. Even the Vedics talk about an age of Kal, like a Kal age and they do say that it's only at certain periods of that cycle that man has a glimmering of the awakening. Maybe that's what I'm tuning into. I really don't know.
Right. Like I remember going over some of this stuff that you covered, like they say that the war will be fought in the air.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, wow, that's true. It is. We're bouncing off satellites. We're talking. You know, it's an information, you know, like Alex Jones says, info wars, you know, but not to mean it in that sense, but in a more metaphysical sense, you know, it's,
absolutely.
It's happening. You know, I can't doubt it. It's right in front of my face. I even see some of the younger kids, you know, that are, you would look at and go, oh, who's this punk, you know, coming to me and going, don't you know about the New World Order? Don't you know about this? You know, haven't you seen the totalitarianism in the streets here? You know? And, I'm going, wow. It really gives me a sense of, hope, you know?
Me too, because remember when I started this work, there was nobody, especially in the days in Ireland, it was absolutely threadbare. And even to this day, you know, Jim Corr, love him or hate him, besides him, who now thinks he's into it, I can name only three of us that were ever in the back in the 70s and 80s deeply into any of this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now it's become somewhat fashionable or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was really threadbare. Now you're seeing an tidal wave of vast interest, and you can be totally shocked by some person just coming straight over to you and saying, you know, hey, guess what the Bilderbergers are doing or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable.
But then you also have a level of co-opting of this too as well, right?
Yeah, of course that's inevitable. Yeah, we have your second fiddles rip you off and all that kind of stuff. That happens. It's inevitable. But my answer to that is that just keep on treading. Keep on, you know, working and doing what you're doing.
As long as you're strong in your own grounding, your own circle, your own 2 feet, it doesn't matter.
No, because it's not, I don't look at it as being my work anyway.
Right.
What I am doing is basically guided, and therefore it's not so much me and my ego, you know.
Right.
My God, I could think of umpteen things I'd love to be doing than this. And I've often said there wasn't a choice at all that I wanted to do this, and I really mean that. That was complete accident or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I've heard you say that many times.
Yeah. But I'm also kind of person that now the ball is in my hands, I'll run with it. Right out the stadium gates, if need be. I have this particular faculty of not letting the ball go. Once it finally has come to me, I'll take it as far as I can take it.
Okay. Yeah, you know, there was one article I read of yours a long while back, and that was on psychic vampirism. And when I started reading it, it wasn't what I expected. It was the story of this child in the coffee shop. And, you know, he's sitting there daydreaming. And he's just got this pristine, you know, awareness of his own thoughts, and his father's just having this totally, you know, narcissistic one-way conversation. And then he sees the boy daydreaming, and he just tells the boy, you know, snap out of it. You're just daydreaming, you know?
And yeah, that was in Seattle, and it was very vivid because it was early in the morning, actually. It was early in the morning, so it was quite still. Everybody was just sort of peaceful.
Yeah.
And so when this guy walks in, it really was startling, you know, kind of thing, and everybody was shocked by it. But the kid just went off and sat down on his own in the corner, like this is habit, let dad go and rant on about his miserable life. And the kid was in but what this was a microcosm of a spirit of the fall of the soul. Basically, in this simple incident, I was able to sort of, almost in Byronic proportions, be able to see the whole story, the metaphor of the soul in the world. Because this kid carried so much soul, went into his own space, went into his own place, was silent and quiet, and he had that magic. But of course, the parent, the system, the man whose mind has been colonized from God knows when, is oblivious to it. In fact, if anything, it's a threat.
Yeah.
Yeah, his own son, his own child, and the energy of that child is a threat.
Wow.
And of course, that is in which a person, there's a known diagnosis that some parents are very much, they may act prideful about a genius child that they have, but that's only for presentation's sake. Outside, that's because it makes them feel good in the community, in the neighborhood, if a child is a great prodigy or genius. And the parents will sort of bask in that glory. But subconsciously, as many psychologists know, they're in deep envy of their child.
Oh, yes. You know, for one part of it, it's like, oh, look what I've accomplished with my child. But at the same time, they're going, oh, I wish I could be that myself.
Yeah, because in reality, that child's gifts. Say it's a girl who turns out to be an incredible gymnast or a brilliant dancer and a ballet dancer. At that point, the mother and the father's competence and adequacy is definitely threatened, especially if they just happen to be kind of run-of-the-mill people.
Yeah.
And haven't achieved their dreams or whatever. The moment that the child turns out to be like, what the hell? Is that Joe Satriani in the next room? Oh, shit. You know, we just bought him the guitar a week ago. Right? That is very compromising because it literally, you have created this child, but this child is an individual and may, you know, he's not trying to do it, but he's going to go and outshine you. And therefore, believe it or not, that causes an incredible amount of subconscious envy. Envy is a very core, you know, vice that we all have as human beings within us. It's not the same thing as jealousy, by the way. This is another big talismanic misconstruing of words.
Right.
Envy is very, very different than jealousy. Jealousy is actually mostly a virtue. It's born out of a virtue. Envy is certainly not. And therefore, this happens in which we envy the great man, envy the great women, envy their abilities. And often, as psychologists also well know, there will be acts of sabotage. There will actually be such bad energy involved. And I've actually have cases of this. One case, for instance, was where a mother was putting so much bad energy towards her daughter, who was a very attractive girl who was obviously going to go on to become a professional ballet dancer, highly classically trained. Something happened where this girl had an accident rollerblading or ice skating and broke her one of the vertebrae in her lower back.
Mm.
At that point, she became completely dependent on the mother.
Wow, yeah.
And when I ran into her later on in her life, and this was just at some cafe or something like that, and I said, yeah, what's your relationship with your mother? You know, she was unloading this whole saga, why she's working in this restaurant and, you know, how she came to be there. And she said, oh, yeah, a couple of years ago she had this accident. So I immediately, you know, get a red flag, and I say, oh, yeah, what's your relationship with your mother like? And she freezes. You see, like, you just stunned her, right?
Deer in the headlights. Then,
yeah, exactly. And then it started coming out that the mother, you know, had resentment, not overt in the beginning, but so that the accident was actually caused by some sort of transference of energy, like some sort of, her envy of her child was so deep, and the child obviously was infected by it, that she subconsciously sabotaged herself by having this accident. Now, how many people fall while skating?
Right.
How much time? What's the chances of you, who's just ready to enter into the first year of an enormously popular, enormously brilliant career, and you break the vertebrae in your lower back, and that's the end of it?
Wow, yeah.
You see, I don't know if it's just me, but those things raise a red flag. I'm not a professional psychologist. I have no degree in the subject. But listen, I know that much.
Yeah.
There's something off with that.
Yeah.
And to me, that reeks of this parental dysfunction. And sure enough, her attitudes, my colleagues were sitting there, they could really see that, you know, you were onto something there. What happened to me? Yeah, I don't want to get into it. It doesn't matter. It's private between her and me, you know. But that was the thing. This girl obviously had been openly sabotaged by her mother, or not openly, but on a subconscious psychological level. And if people were more sensitive to that, if they were aware of how they themselves, their lives have been truly sabotaged, then they'd have a healthy outlet for their anger. Right? They wouldn't be sitting there trying to excuse it. They'd face a fact. Yeah, my parents sabotaged me. I'm right to be angry about that. And I'm also right to be hurt about it. And if you then take the next psychological step of saying, I'd rather express my hurt over it as opposed to my anger, then you're on the road to enlightenment.
Right.
So see how quickly it suddenly becomes, like we've been saying from the outset, you take these steps. They're actually not that those steps are not complicated. You talked earlier just a few minutes ago about the incredible complexity of the lie.
Yeah.
And one of the offshoots of that is that it makes you think that the road to your truth is also extremely complex. See, once you're affected by the confusion and the apathy and the futility, it makes you feel that a thing that's just a few feet away is miles away. It's like a play on your mind.
Well, you think it must be if it's so complex on that side. You think, oh, well, it must be just as complex and just as,
right.
You know, it's sort of, you know, it's a false perception. You know, you have a false preconceived notion of even where you're going before you even step off the chair.
Remember I said you can strangle yourselves in the web of trying to be free of the web?
Yeah.
Weight is on your back. You're actually carrying the weight The beast is plugged into you, man. It's sitting on your back. It's like a monkey on your shoulder. You're actually carrying it. What I often refer to as the stone in the shoe stops you climbing the mountain. You have all these aspirations of what you're going to do and where you're going to go and how brilliant you're going to be, but you haven't removed the simple, tiny psychological obstacles. Once you do, then you will be able to attain all of those things. So my work and my teachings is always to try and help people observe what that stone in the shoe is, because for everybody, it's not going to be the same for everyone. But what I really mean is that the journey to your enlightenment and your awakening is really not that difficult. That's more of an illusion. It's because you have bricks on top of the air balloon. It can't rise of its own free will. You don't even need to steer the thing. It will. Your higher self knows exactly where to go. It's like I use the metaphor of throwing the oars away in the boat. Well, don't say that, Michael. We can't do that. Why not? The river knows where it's going. If you don't have trust in the river, you're going to exhaust your energy rowing.
It's like the Hopi. The Hopi say this.
Yeah. And it's very needed for our times right now. In fact, I would say it's a matter of life and death right now. This has become very important for people in daily life today. They're not going to have a choice in it. This countdown to 2012, I've always read it as being not some sort of final ascension that's going to take place when you buy the ticket. No, it's an ongoing process of you cleansing your understanding, opening the doors of perception, partly to understand that we're not saying jump out of the boat of ego consciousness into the river. I'm not saying that. I'm saying stay well within your ego. But you don't need the oars as if your ego now knows the entire map and what's coming around the river and where you're going. You must have some level of trust of the universe. That's what makes life brilliant. You have your fixity, but you also have your spontaneity. You have your head in the clouds, but your feet on the ground. This is what people are lacking. Too much in the New Age movement and other religions, you're meant to just divorce yourself, disassociate your mind from the living reality. God will take care of it. Or you're a materialist type of person who goes to hell with anything to do with speculative metaphysics and mystical traditions and all that sentimentality. I'm just going to get along. I've a long ago exchanged love for power anyway. And through power, I will attain everything that I want. Through my power, I'll get the adoration that I so desperately need. And through power, I'll be able to punish those who don't give it to me.
Yes.
And this is how society splits itself down the middle.
Yeah, and we also see people, they gravitate towards the people who are the forerunners of that, you know, the most corrupted in that sense, you know. People just get right behind them and say, wow.
But again, to answer your question about the psychic vampirism, it's just a question of hunger.
Right.
You have two kinds of hunger in the world. Remember we talked about the kind of passion and emotion, the true emotion that inspires you on all levels? That's a hunger, by the way.
Yeah.
So all people have two kinds of hunger. People have a hunger for knowledge and truth. But that's not the same kind of hunger as the hunger of emptiness when you're dead. You don't have anything within you.
Yeah.
Right? That's all I meant by that.
I gotcha.
Concept. Is there's two kinds of hunger, and you have to start to distinguish between people that you meet. What kind of hunger do they have? Because the world is filled with hungry people who are hungry because they're literally emaciated psychically.
Right.
And there's another kind of hunger, of the hunger that I can't sleep, I'm on fire, I'm a restless person, I'm a rebellious person, I'm not easy to get along with, I'm asking questions because I'm very hungry, but it's the hunger of trying to find out what is real. Am I seeing reality correctly or am I being deceived? Am I deceiving myself? I want to see things as they are. The other type of hunger couldn't give a monkeys about whether he's seeing reality or not. Reality is he's already divorced from reality. He's the furthest thing away from it. All he wants is your approval.
Right.
And whatever else you can give him, you see. So this is a different kind of hunger.
Okay.
And we have that on the governmental level. We have it on the royal level. We have it on religious level. We have it on local government level. And we have it in the family unit. So to me, the tyranny is not, oh my God, what are we going to do with the tyranny of the Big Brother and the Illuminati and, my God, the Alpha Lodges of Freemasonry? Yeah, come on, Michael, what are we going to do about it? We're not leading any attack here because it's a pestilence that starts on the one-to-one level first.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, in the one is reflected in the ten.
Yeah. And if you happen to be infected by the disease, what good are you going to do charging in there with your blindness, your working blindness, to try and make others see? We've tried this for hundreds of years, by the way. There's been every conceivable form of philosophy, every conceivable form of ideology and politics and reform and revolution that the mind can come up with, and not one of it has worked. There's more depression now in the world, it's been escalating every year, by the way, than there was before Sigmund Freud wrote his first book that launched the psychoanalytical movement. How does that work? That you think that the very subject of psychology that should be helping to alleviate depression.
Right.
Yes, it has done on individual cases. I'm not knocking it, by the way. But I'm saying that there's something else going on in life that psychology is obviously unable to touch. And we've already been talking about what it is. It's submission. Because even when you want fixing psychologically, you're going to a fixer. The underlying problem that even contaminates psychology is you are going to another person. You're sitting in front of a man. You don't know who he is. He may beat his kids. He may eat raw meat. He may be a pedophile. You have no idea. Who is this guy with a white coat? You are literally thinking like you've done with the priests through all time, like you've done with all the gurus through all time. You now just replace those authorities, confessional. You just replace the confessional with some other monkey who may be a total materialist, never given a single thought in his life to the higher meaning of life, and now he's going to counsel you? You may be saner than he is. And by the way, in most cases, schizophrenics, they are clever and smarter. Read R.D. Lang, read Arno Gruen, read Thomas Szasz. They're telling you that schizophrenic can see through the doctor faster than he can see through them. That's why they're schizophrenics. They're not buying into any lies anymore.
Right. Right. Okay, Michael, I think that's a good place. Maybe we can wrap it up here and do a little question and answer session. I know you're a busy man and you got to get back to your life. And,
no, let's go for that. That's fine.
I just want to say to the chat room, is there anyone who has any particular questions they'd like to put through to Michael right now? Go ahead and post a couple in the chat or something, and I'll relay them to him. And if not, we'll go ahead and wrap this up. I have a question here from Sophie. We also call her Lady of Lake. She's a clinical psychologist and a certified astrologer. She wants to know, what form of astrology do you use?
I use my own. I've invented a whole form of astrology. That's what my mystery school is all about. I have an entire form of divination that incorporates the tarot, astrology, Kabbalah, and numerology as one divination art. It's loosely based. It has elements, of course, of the Western system. Obviously, we always use a 12-house system, and to that extent. But it's less based on astrology as it is based on tarot, and it's a combination of all the different divination arts. There's a lot of information on that on my Taroscopes website, which you can also get to by way of the Michael Tessarian website.
Okay, and I have another question. This was coming from Scotland, and the question is, I would like to know what Michael's seeing of Krishnamurti. They seem to be the same thing.
Yeah, well, there's two Krishnamurtis, J, that's Jiddu Krishnamurti, and G Krishnamurti. I'm assuming he's speaking about the more famous Jiddu Krishnamurti.
It's a she, actually.
Huh?
It's a she, actually, asking the question.
Oh, I see, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up in the Krishnamurti tradition.
Wow.
My family went to his pilot school, which is in India, and some of my family members actually had a role in helping create the school. So my family was very much involved in the Krishnamurti movement back in the 1920s and 30s. And so I would say that even though I never actually went to a bona fide Krishnamurti school, I myself grew up in what you might loosely call that tradition. But that tradition also included sort of like a Rudolf Steiner, you know, Waldorf type of education. Again, not in any formal way. I never went to any of these schools. But as I say, my family moved in that circle. They were very much in the movement of Krishnaji.
All
right. Both in America and in other parts of the world. I never met Krishnaji personally. I saw him live at a talk. I went to some of his talks, but I never had dialogue with him. But I'm very much we never used the word follower. He never used it, and I certainly wouldn't use it. Yeah. But, you know, his teachings have had a very profound effect in my life, and I certainly recommend his work to everyone else.
Okay. We have one more question here. And this one is from Panther333. I'm not aware of who he is or where he's from. But what are your feelings on HARP and its electromagnetic effect on mankind?
The HARP? The human HARP?
No, HARP. The H-A-A-R-P.
Oh,
yeah, that thing.
Well, that's a long story. Mostly what everybody else is saying. I agree with it. It's a deadly thing. It's funded by British establishment. By the way, it's another one that's funded by the aristocracy. That's proven.
Yeah.
And it's for multiple things. My biggest take on it is twofold. I believe that HARP or similar type of microwave technology is responsible for the vast majority of crop circles that have been appearing now for the last 20 years or whatever. I write about that in the Atlantis book. There's a whole chapter on it called Crops in the Fields or whatever the title of the chapter is.
Right.
Circles in the Crops or something. And the second thing I say about it is that it's mostly used, HARP itself is being used to break through what I describe as the Stargate, which is an encircling field of energy that has encased this Earth for several thousand years now. And it's basically been a field of energy that has incarcerated, kept in quarantine, the Nephilim.
Okay.
Again, there's the whole Atlantis book sketches this out. It's very right. long to go into. But through the different generations, this Nephilim coterie, not them themselves, but their descendants, have been trying desperately to find a way to break out of this barrier. And they've tried science, they've tried occultism, they've tried various things. And as they've moved forward into the modern age, they're now using, they've used atomic explosions, by the way. They've used all forms of laser. And now they're using HARP. HARP is actually, in my book, in my understanding, designed specifically to try and penetrate these extremely powerful radioactive layers, which already exist around the planet naturally, and this other phenomena that I refer to as the Stargate, which is just a phrase. It doesn't mean anything more than that. It's an encircling field of energy that does not allow any humanoid to leave the planet. And, of course, these beings were once interstellar, the people that are behind the entire world conspiracy.
Right.
And they are wanting to get out, like mega. And even right now, this last 2 weeks, they've released an unmanned shuttle, just happens to be called the Dragon. And one of the things I go into is the terminology of the various programs and the symbolism that these corporations use. Because remember, this is a edifice that stretches all over the world and involves innumerable companies, not just MIT and NASA, but many other companies. Lockheed Martin. There's been an entire movement for hundreds of years, all centering itself to try and create this kind of technology. It's involved also in genetics. Most of what you're seeing today in the genome projects and genetics is also linked, by the way, to this project of vacating the planet. And just this last week, it's a good thing this guy asked this question, because this very week you can go onto the forum. If people go into my forum, click on the Atlantis page, you'll see the post I just put there. They've released an unmanned probe, and it just happens to be called the Dragon. People who've read my Atlantis book will know exactly why that's significant.
Yes, and it falls right in line with the rest of the names they have, doesn't it? The Atlantis shuttle for the Discovery and all this.
Oh, Gemini, Gemini, the Voyager, whatever, all the crazy names, Atlantis.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this?
Why these names, right?
SETI.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an English word. Yeah, that's easy to remember. Why did you pick that? It just happens to be the name of an ancient god of Egypt. Okay, what's going on here, you know?
And Lucifer, we have the Lucifer telescope and the Vatican controlled telescope there.
I remember that one. And even the names of the planets themselves, it's non-ending.
Yeah.
And then the demotion of the planet Pluto, the new discoveries about the sunspots creating problems with radiocarbon dating. Oh, that's not a small thing. But then if you recall these people and say, why did you name the thing the Dragon? They would get out of it by saying, well, for hundreds of years in recorded time, comets were often considered dragons in the heavens. So that's why we call it. It's just an allusion to comets.
Yeah.
That's how they get out of it, you see.
You know,
They're not stupid. They have plenty of other excuses for the layman who will say, oh, interesting name. Why did you call it that? Oh, well, don't you know the whole history of the... And in fact, that's why we do fireworks. Remember at Halloween here?
Right.
And in fact, not Halloween, right now, even the...
New Year's.
What's it called? New Year's palava.
You're like me. You don't even pay attention to it, do you?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
When you're walking past houses where they have all the lights out and the little fairy lights, and then you see people even shooting the fireworks, that's all to commemorate the stars in the heavens, the cometary disasters that took place, the witches on their broomsticks.
Right.
A witch on a broomstick is an allusion to a comet.
Oh, wow, yeah. I never thought of it that way at all, ever.
Thor's hammer, Thor's lightning bolts, Jupiter's lightning bolts, Poseidon's trident. I've gone into this in all the books.
Right.
In the books, there's a... and then again, another one is the dragon, the swirling dragon. You know the way the Chinese will not only run through the streets with their dragon, but they'll light a lot of fireworks beside it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they will.
Yeah, there's always crackling fireworks. We have Diwali in India. All the in Sweden, you have the Santa Lucia, the Night of Lights. All of this palaver is to commemorate the heavenly stars. They look different in ancient days. The moon, theoretically, might have been closer to our planet. And not only that, but you had these enormous destructions. And then to represent that man still survived after all that calamity, to commemorate that we should never forget that we are grateful for survival, they light the same, it's like sympathetic magic. You go around lighting all these lights.
Wow.
So they would allude to that. They say, oh, no, that's just in mythology. You know, we're very up on mythology, and we named it the dragon. And you'd be pacified. You wouldn't know, no. It's a bit, little bit more than just fireworks in the sky is the reason you called it the dragon.
Yeah.
The dragon is a very, very powerful secret. It's almost one of the number one secret society emblems, secret society logos, and it is pertaining to their own bloodline.
I see. Yeah.
This like is the green dragon.
The Green Dragon Lodge, you know?
The Green Dragon Lodge. All of these illusions. The medical. If you look at the Caduceus, you see the serpent, right? The hermetics. The medics. Now, these guys name that the dragon because that's them. That's their bloodline getting off the planet Earth. And the consequences for them ever breaking through that stargate will be absolutely devastating to us. Because that's, they're saying that's their hope is going up there. The dragon is leaving. The dragon is going up. Not to do with some cometary action or allusions to fireworks periodically. This is to do with their own bloodline. They think of themselves as the Dragon Dynasty, the Dragon Court, as I've explained throughout my work.
Well,
and they're still at it. And now what they've done is they don't say it's the government doing it. Oh, it's a private-funded company. See, they've moved the whole space program over to what they now refer to as private companies, meaning giant corporations controlled by the Illuminati. Yeah, as the government was. It's just that the government is too transparent, so any of these projects that were done through governmental auspices have too many media people looking over their shoulder. In fact, there's even been investigative journalists, right, who blew the whistle on the moon gate, who blew the whistle on the moon landing. It's all fake. Right. So the government doesn't fund the project anymore. There's too many witnesses, too many people looking over the fence. But if you say it's a private company, you damn better believe it is private. Right? So they can now conduct their business, the stuff that I've been revealing. They can conduct that business under completely closed doors.
Yes. You know how people think they know, you know, everything's so public with NASA, you know, and this, that. I live 40 miles from the launch site, Michael, and down here at Kennedy Space Center. And they launch stuff all the time without it being on the schedule. It's like, what is this? You know?
That's
2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, you got a huge multi-billion-dollar rocket going off with no news about it.
That's right. Planes can crash into the Pentagon, smash into the Twin Towers. Nobody knows. Anybody on a schedule here? Anybody knows what's going on? Why these planes didn't? What are they doing here? And where is our guys over here?
Yeah,
that's right. Everything's all open. And then the website, the military websites, as Alex Jones has shown, where they actually had the original information about these logistics of when the flight should have taken off and when they shouldn't have.
Right.
Oh, it's there for years, but in the week of 9/11, it vanishes.
Right. I mean, the planes, NORAD stood down. The planes, you know, should have been launched to take these planes down. This system's been in place for 20 years, you know.
Right.
You know, it only takes 8 minutes for them to scramble or something. Maybe Kismet could straighten me out on that. She's good.
Yeah, the Project for New America, all of these websites that contained information, the moment that they knew that now people were coming to look at it, they are immediately taken down. Lots of these government websites, .gov websites and police websites and what have you, military websites are immediately updated, instantly, the moment that they know that there's an investigative journalist or there's a story or a reportage taking place or there's questions being asked. They immediately change the websites overnight. Now, that's disclosure. My ass.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any more questions coming up here, and I think we'll go ahead. We're reaching a little past the two-hour mark here, and just thanking you very much for joining us here. I think, hold on, I got one more question for you, Michael, and this is coming from my co-host over here. He's got to get this in. He's been waiting very patiently, so give me just a second.
Sure.
Just go ahead and speak, Will.
How you doing, Mr. Zasarian? I really enjoyed your entire speech and everything, and you talking on our show today. You were talking earlier about basically a collective consciousness, and you were talking about how children actually are kind of like controlled by the parent as they're growing up and everything. I've been looking at a lot of things, and I've been seeing how basically humans in general are both they're both individuals as well as they're collective. And I was wondering, if you were to be raising a child, how would you go about, you know, trying to raise them in a collective sense, but still help them to retain their own individuality?
Well, I'll be going into that in future DVDs because it's a very lengthy process. It's also very important. Remember we were talking about the walls of the ego, the defenses that are there?
Yeah.
We were talking about those defenses being as a result of trauma. They're also partly there because of this conditioning from the world, from the parents. When a child is born, it almost has no walls.
Right.
The pure, unadulterated child, even this is subject to specific cases, but in general I would say that the child's mind doesn't have these strong defensive walls until it meets the parent.
Right.
It's the parent and the siblings and the whole family dynamic that start creating these defenses and armorings, not only biologically in the child's body, but certainly in the mind of the child. Now, a parent knowing this, it goes without saying that they should be into psychology. They should study as much as they can about children, maybe dabble, get into some of the Steiner material, get into some of the Krishnamurti material, because they specialized in the right way to bring up children. So the Scottish caller earlier who was asking about Krishnamurti is appropriate now, because Krishnamurti specialized, basically his personal philosophy is you're talking to the dead when you're talking to anybody over 30. And therefore, he tried to spend his life, he had a lot of problems in his life getting away from other things he was involved in order to focus his energy entirely on children's schools, because he gave up hope on everybody else. But his work and Rudolf Steiner schools, these are at least a very good place to begin. There's lots of other things I'll be recommending, as I say, later on when I do these programs on it. The other thing, of course, is that parenting is all about watching yourself.
Huh.
It's not about watching the child. The child is quite, you know, capable of handling its own life.
Right.
And doing what it needs to do. So the parenting first step is to realize that you're not perfect. All parents believe that they're having this child as some sort of toy or crutch, and they're in a supreme authority. I know this is not conscious, but it is unconscious. Parents, when they have a child, have become, for whatever moment, whatever time it's going to take, the big dictator. And therefore, they slowly, without even knowing it, start to operate towards the child in this power dynamic. So it's being observing of that, that just because you think that you're all powerful, because you, in your littleness of your daily life or your own failures through your own life, now you think you're having a child that will give you some sense of power. This is the first thing that the parent needs to address. And handle that and not be so dictatorial. Observe their own need for power, need for control, and so on. Next step they can do is that they must accept that they're fallible, that they're not perfect. Too many parents want to be perfect so badly that that becomes another problem. So it's very important for the parent to say, I know I don't know all the rules. I'm learning as I go. And those are, I would say, just a few basic preliminaries. But when you get more into the heart of your question, one thing I can certainly say is that unless you convey to your child a complete emotional repertoire, you are going to be in serious problems. Because if you, for instance, are not in touch with your own hurt, in touch with your own anger, in touch with your own emotion, the joy, the real, you can dance around the room and feel good about something, your humor, your sadness, your moods, your tears, then unfortunately, your child who's watching you is going to learn, just like what you are, the only emotion that you ever show, which in America is, it's everything's fine, everything's kushti, hey, it's all good, it's all good, it's all good, mommy isn't crying, there's no pain, there's no suffering, I didn't have a bad day at work, it's marvelous, the sun is shining, it's great, TV. The child does not know what it is to weep. The child does not know what it is to mourn. The child does not know what it means to burn with anger. The child does not know what it means to have hatred. The child does not know what it means to have passion. The child is dead.
Yes.
I see
because
this.
The parent is dead. The parent has no emotional repertoire.
Yeah, I see this a lot in my generation. I'm 22, and I see it a lot where teenagers and people around my age, they either shifting into one full spectrum of emotion, or they're just totally emotionless altogether. They don't know how to go about living with happiness or joy or with anger or anything. They're just mellow, or they just don't care. They're always in rage or whatnot. And also talking about, you know, children being looked at as like toys and as just being, I guess you can say, like a pet or whatnot. Yes. I see that also in my generation and generation before and before mine and after mine. Kids are having kids, basically, and it's just, oh, well, I want a kid because it just seems so awesome to have a kid, or it'd be nice to be a parent right now, and they themselves aren't really grown up, or they themselves aren't really prepared for that, and they don't know what to do. They're not pushing towards anything, but, oh, well, I see this thing as just being mine, not its own individual or its own entity.
The individuality threatens the hell out of the parent. It causes them a deep subconscious dread that then leads to that envy. And you're right about the young giving birth to the young. It's biology has replaced psychology. They hate themselves. They hate their own emotions. They can't live with themselves. So now you take the easiest way out. Biology. Biology will take over. I have to have a kid. I'm a woman, aren't I? I must have a kid. I'm a man at this age. What am I going to feel like with my mates if I don't follow this function? I don't know who the hell I am. Well, but that can take a back seat. I'm capable of raising a child. All you got to do is tell it what to do. Well, that's easy.
Yes. Yes.
Straight jacket ready.
And we're surprised that we have such people that can't deal with emotion, that they want
to
take a pill.
Don't punishment is incarceration. When you send somebody to a room, you're no different than the judge who says, okay, you stole something, off you go to jail. Yeah. The parent does it every day. Or denying a child a gift, or denying its food. So some parents even deny the food, the comfort. You're locked in. You can't eat. You're going to be denied a privilege that we promised you. All the mind games that parents play, those have to be observed. They have to be deconstructed. And unfortunately, we're not going to see that in today's world. That's why the children of this generation and many of the ones from before are like this. You can't listen to that kind of music. You know, why not listen to that kind of music? See, I grew up listening to a lot of heavy metal, right? That is a very, very important genre of music because, number one, it not only deals with rage, it has themes of violence, it has themes of anger, it has themes of rage, but it articulates it. So one of the last points I'll say on this is language. The child must be exposed to the language that allows it to express itself. Of course, that'll be lacking in some goon parent who doesn't read and just sits in the front of the TV all day.
Yeah.
If you don't give the child the language to express its hurt, that is one of the noted psychological, and it's a very it's one of the latest theories, by the way. This has now become a whole school of theory, and I agree with it. And they say this is what defines a psychopath from a normal criminal. You know, they've even noticed this, that the psychopath is the one who never had in his background the language to express the way he was, where the average criminal in the few cells down is not so much sociopathic or psychopathic because he tended to be able to express himself. And then when psychologists have gone in to treat very seriously criminal people or deranged people, they find that the highest success rates are with those who have picked up books in the prison, learned how to speak properly, articulate their feelings. They have record amounts of recovery, whereas the people who refuse to do this remain exactly the same way they are. And I don't know if you watch a lot of forensic shows. Your audience may remember that many of these forensic profilers will always say that the higher that you go up the ladder of criminality, like to the serial killers, the less you get out of them. I don't know if people have noticed this anecdote.
Right.
But the higher you go up to the worst kind of criminals, the more stum they are, the more they are either playing games or simply will not reveal their motives.
Wow.
And that ties into this point that I'm talking about, is that they can't. They don't even have the introversion or the means to express themselves. So if a child is not brought up on classic literature, great movies, you know, painting, and lots of talk included in the parental conversations and socialized a lot and has an extended family in which you can banter back and forth, it will inhibit its ability to express its own emotions. And then again, add to that the limited repertoire of emotions from a parent, and you have a really, really big problem that's going to manifest not when the kid's just teenage, but as early as 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Well, Michael, I don't see any more questions, and This has been just an absolute honor for me personally.
Well, we'll do it again. You know, do another one down the line.
Yeah.
There's so much to go into, you know.
Yeah. And I know you're all over the place. You're doing, you know, coast to coast AM. You're doing, you know, this show, that show, and yeah. If you find, you know, time, and you know, you got some time, just ring me up, or you know, just pop in and say, hey, you want to do another show? And I'm always game for stuff like that.
Be glad to. I prefer to do them. I've said this before, and I mean it. I prefer to do the smaller, you know, shows like yours, because I believe in them much better. It's my cup of tea as opposed to the big shows. I get offered to do big mainstream things all the time.
Right.
I repeatedly turn them down for various reasons, you know, so I'm very happy when it's one of the reasons is that they don't know anything. They're not like you. They're not up to speed on the actual content and information. So that to me is a big no-no right there, you know.
Right.
I'm not a performing seal or a juggler, you know. I want an audience and hosts who are really actively themselves interested and passionate about this information. That's what it's all about for me, not anything else.
Yeah, in other words, you're not doing this, you know, for being pretty. You're doing this for us.
No.
You know?
No. Absolutely not.
All right.
Anyway, thanks, guys. Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay, anytime, Michael. And, you know, lots of good comments here coming up in the room. I couldn't pass them all on. It's just endless comments here in the room. Just thumbs up. Thank you very much, you know, and people were just totally impressed by this information.
Well, remember, it is collaborative. Anyone who's studied my website see that, you know, this, the forum, it's collaboration.
Right.
A huge part of this as well. No one man can do it all. It's not possible.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to end this here. I'm going to start recording now. And everyone who joined us in the chat, thank you very much. And Michael's work you can find at everything at michaeldesarian.com. And Michael, you got a new YouTube page. It's unslavedfilms.com. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we got three actually. We got the Architects of Control channel, we've got the MSAR TV channel, and Unslaved Films channel.
Yeah, and you can check out his Red Ice Creations interview. Very good. Psychonautilus, the host from Psychonautilus, Michael, was in here just a little while ago. He's actually a great friend of mine.
That's super.
Adam.
All my interviews will be on the forum under What's New.
Okay. Okay. So everyone can get all the interviews he's done there, and we'll post.
I'll get a copy from you guys of this one.
Yeah, sure, Michael. I'll send it to you. You want me to go ahead and edit it, or you want it raw? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, edit it. Edit, please.
All right, we'll go ahead and edit it out and get it to you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And
gotta get this call, but I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay, so that concludes our interview with Michael Desarian, part two. I want to thank you all for coming and listening to Atlantis 3D Radio. The rain has subsided somewhat here in the background, so it's really a sort of an opportunity, I think, to thank each and every one of you out there that are promoting the show behind the scenes. I would also like to remind you all that Michael Desarian's work can be found over at michaeldesarian.com. His last name is spelled TSARION, and any future shows and information will be published on atlantis3d.110mb.com. So check the site for future updates and whatnot. And with all this, we're going to take you out of here with a little music from the Tunguska Electronic Music Society. This track is titled My Twin.
I'm sick of it.